Well, good afternoon, and welcome to this event at the U.S. Institute of Peace on Public Opinion in Pakistan. My name is Ian Larson. I'm Director of Public Affairs and Communication here at the Institute. I wanted to take just a few minutes, hopefully less than a few minutes even that, to talk a bit before I turn it over, turn the events today over to our three speakers. When we scheduled this event and sent out our invitation in mid-December, there was no way that we would have known just how much the situation in this country would have changed by the time the event took place. We anticipated having an event that would be taking place one day before the Pakistani elections, and certainly that situation has changed greatly. If Pakistani public opinion was important in mid-December, it is certainly crucial now. There's no question about that, and so I think we're even we look at today's events as even more important than we did just a few weeks ago. Today's event and the poll that we'll be talking about are a joint project of the U.S. Institute of Peace and WorldPublicOpinion.org. Pakistan is one of the Institute's Tier 1 priority conflict zones. I'd like to just give you a brief overview of some of the work that the Institute is currently doing in Pakistan. I know probably most of you had a chance to take a look at the products that are on the table, both from the Institute and WorldPublicOpinion.org. Among the work that we're doing now, we work to develop policy-relevant analysis of internal security problems in the country. We're working to engage U.S. policymakers on key problems and provide training and mediation assistance on key issues of domestic strife where USIP has niche capabilities. Specifically, we have a Pakistan peace education textbook and teacher training that is forthcoming, a leadership skills program for Pakistani women, and we have more than $300,000 in solicited grants for Pakistani organizations and more than $500,000 in active grants with Pakistani organizations. There are several publications I'd like to call your attention to. There's information on the front table about Christine Fair's monograph on Madrasa Challenge, as well as the book by Christine and Peter Chalk on Fortifying Pakistan. And we also have brand new today, I believe, a new USIP working paper on the jihadi terrain in Pakistan that I hope all of you will take a look at. It's available. All of these documents are available on the website as well. Our speakers today are Christine Fair, who we are always very happy to welcome back to the Institute. Christine was with us up until the end of 2007 when she left to go over to RAND. As well as Clay Ramsey and Steve Ball, excuse me, from PIPA. I'm going to step out of the way now. I really want to leave as much time for substance as possible for today's event because I think there's going to be a lot of meat to talk about and a lot of questions afterward. Thanks very much.
Well, I think before turning it over to Steve and Clay, I thought it might be useful to give you a little bit of an idea about why we did this survey. PIPA and USIP have been now working for, a year and a half together on a variety of projects, first on Iran. And then I guess it was about a year ago, working with START, PIPA fielded a very interesting survey in Pakistan, but three other countries as well. And the objective of that study was to try to understand how folks in these different countries understood the terrorist threat, how they saw the United States in the world and in their country. And the value of that survey, of course, was that it asked a standard set of questions through which they could compare public attitudes across these four countries. Well, after having been working with PIPA for quite some time, it occurred to me that we could take that excellent instrument that they put forth across these four countries and try to tailor it more specifically to Pakistan, and that's what we did. Now, just so you know, this was fielded in September, long before the events that probably brought you here today. But I think some of the attitudes that you're going to see about Pakistani support and threat perception of different militants, the events in Pakistan's tribal areas, are still very much salient, and I would argue even more so after the declaration of emergency, after the assassination of Benazir Bhutto. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Steve and to Clay.
Good afternoon. I'm the research director at Program on International Policy Attitudes, and thank you all for coming. So this survey was conducted from September 12th through September 18th with a multi-stage probability sample of 907 urban adults who were interviewed in their homes in 19 cities that vary in size from just over 10,000 up to millions. All four provinces were included, and the margin of error is plus or minus 3.3%. In Pakistan's current turmoil, an essential background question is how important democracy is to the public. We asked, how important is it for you to live in a country that is governed by representatives elected by the people? On a scale of 1, not at all important, to 10, absolutely important. And the average answer was 8.4, and 71% gave an answer of 8 or higher. But when they were next asked to assess how much Pakistan is governed in this way, the average response was just 4.8, and only 18% answered 8 or higher. We asked the same kind of question about the independence of the judiciary, a foundation of real democracy, asked, how important is it for you to live in a country where the decisions of the courts are independent from influence by political and military authorities? The average response was 8.6, and again, 71% gave a score of 8 or higher. 52% gave it a 10. But their assessment of real judicial independence in Pakistan was lukewarm, with an average response of 5.6. So these numbers suggest a good deal of dissatisfaction, and this showed when respondents were asked about their confidence in national institutions. We asked this question here about many institutions, but here are four key ones. The empty spaces in the bars represent those who did not answer. Clear majorities expressed low confidence in the national government as a whole, the office of the president, the National Assembly, and their provincial assembly. So, what about the other pillar of a state named an Islamic Republic, the role of Islam in norms of governance? We asked the question that's the obvious counterpart to our questions about democracy. How important is it for you to live in a country that is governed according to Islamic principles? And the average response was 9.0. And when they were asked how much Pakistan is governed in this way, the average answer was 4.6. Now, naturally, we wanted to know how those who felt most strongly this way felt about democracy. So we took those who put the greatest importance on living in a country governed by Islamic principles and found out how many of them gave Pakistan a low score in this regard. Among these people, it's the third or so who were most dissatisfied about Islam's role in governance. 72% of this group gave the importance of democracy a 10. That's 22 points higher than the full sample. So the dissatisfaction that you see in this slide about the place of Islamic principles is not a separate thing from the views about Pakistani democracy that you saw just a moment ago. Similarly, we asked about Sharia's role in current Pakistani law. 60% said they feel its role should be larger. Among this 60%, two-thirds of this group gave the importance of democracy a 10. We then asked more specific questions that were meant to test where people's opinions were along the wide spectrum of Islamic thought and experience about governance, and I'll show you four of these. Here's a first test. The term Talibanization of daily life was in wide use by Pakistani media at the time of the poll to designate extreme religious conservatism and even armed militancy. Just 15% said they would like to see this increase. Only 4% wanted it to increase a lot. 59% said it should either go down or at least stay the same. Those who said they wanted the role of Sharia to increase did not particularly want more Talibanization. They answered this question just like the rest of the sample did. Here's a second and quite different test. We told people of the government's plan to reform the madrasas or madaris. This plan would require madrasas to register with the government and to spend more time in class on subjects like mathematics and science. 64% said they favored this plan, and only 17% opposed it. Those who wanted the role of Sharia to increase were a bit more likely than others to favor this plan strongly. Here's a third test. In this question, we told respondents that the government passed a law called the Women's Protection Act, which made changes in laws called the Hudud Ordinances. Now, this change made the laws significantly less harsh for women, but we didn't tell them that in the question. A plurality of 38% supported the change. 27% were opposed. Many volunteered that they had not heard of the law. So this finding's less strong, but it does suggest majority disinterest in extreme religious conservatism. A fourth test had to do with the attacks on religious minorities carried out by some extreme groups. An 81% majority said it was important for the unity of Pakistan to protect religious minorities in Pakistan. Only a minuscule 8% said this was not important. So, taken together, these findings suggest that there is strong public support for giving Islamic principles a greater role in governance, but this does not mean support for extreme religious conservatism. On the contrary, there's significant support for reforms going in the opposite direction. Of course, in practice, the army is a primary institution in Pakistani public life. We asked a variety of different questions about the army because its roles are so multidimensional and people might have different feelings about different roles. So first, here's the broadest measure of confidence in the military. Asked about the army and other armed forces, people expressed substantial confidence. A 69% majority said they had a great deal or quite a lot. Only 23% said they had less than that. Then we asked about the Army's performance in different fields. The public's approval of the Army's performance is strongest in the strictly military field. 84% said the Army was doing a good or excellent job defending Pakistan's borders and territory. For helping with economic development, most were still favorable, and so 66% in all said the Army was doing a good job. For taking part in how Pakistan is governed, you see approval starting to thin out. In all, 53% approved and 36% were critical. We also tried asking about performance in a different way. We asked, please tell me if you think the Army has had a mostly positive or mostly negative influence on each of the following. For the economy, there was little enthusiasm. Only 23% said the Army has had a mostly positive influence, and 32% called it negative. People were more favorable about its participation in the program called National Reconstruction, 29% to 19%. The atmosphere is even frostier when people are asked about the Army's influence on the justice system. Only 17% called it good, and on the Constitution and the rule of law, you have a similar level. Among those who answered, it was a wash about the Army's influence on education, 23% each way, and a few more, 26%, saw the Army's influence on the media as negative, compared to 21% positive. So this series of answers shows a different side of the public's view of the Army. A low enthusiasm for the Army's presence in far-flung activities that can coexist with ordinary patriotic pride in Pakistan's army as such. When the general question was put to them, as a general rule, should the armed forces be limited to strictly military matters, or should they take a wider role in the country's affairs? A 41% plurality opted for limiting the armed forces, while a third came out for them taking a wider role. Now, this suggests to me that some of them were saying, well, how wide? That is, it seems unlikely that the majority wants to completely fence the army out of every aspect of civil society, but they don't seem to think that its influence has been good in many areas. For policymakers, it's a primary question whether militant groups find sympathy and resonance among the Pakistani public, and if so, to what degree. We asked whether people saw the following activities as a threat or not to the vital interests of Pakistan in the next 10 years. If they called it a threat, we then asked whether they thought it was a critical threat or just important but not critical. 60% in all saw the activities of Islamist militants and local Taliban in Fatah and settled areas as a threat. About as many said the same for the activities of Al-Qaeda. And 61% said this for the activities of domestic militant organizations. Only 14 to 18% said any of these does not threaten Pakistan. We asked people to think in general about the most spectacular tactic of these organizations, attacks on civilians. Some people think that bombing and other types of attacks intentionally aimed at civilians are sometimes justified, while others think that this kind of violence is never justified. Only 15% said such attacks are sometimes justified. 66% disagreed with this, and 55% said they were never justified. So the minority that is willing to stick up for the tactic as such is not very big. Now, we wanted to go further and test the kind of ideological statement often mustered to provide justification for attacks aimed at civilians. One such argument is that since Pakistan was founded as the home for South Asia's Muslims, Pakistan has an obligation to protect all Muslims of South Asia, presumably by any means. So we said some people make the statement that Pakistan has a moral obligation to protect Muslims anywhere in South Asia. Do you agree or disagree? Well, 66% agreed and 21% disagreed, and this suggests perhaps the familiarity of this kind of statement to them. Those who agreed then heard, to protect Muslims in South Asia, do you think Pakistan should only use peaceful means or use any means, including force? Only 12% said they thought force should be used for this purpose. 51% said only peaceful means should be used. And another 21% in the line above rejected the statement in the first place. So add these together, 72% did not agree with the underlying thrust of this statement when it's used to justify attacks on civilians. The opposite end of this problem of violence, however, is how Pakistanis view the use of force by the government against armed militant groups. The military assault on the groups that barricaded themselves in the Red Mosque in Islamabad was controversial itself, and then it was followed by heightened militant activity in the northwest. 64% thought that the use of force at the Red Mosque was a mistake. Only 22% approved of this use of force. Another aspect of the problem is whether Pakistanis are aware in the first place that attacks on civilians are practiced by specific militant groups. To try to find out, we ask about three different domestic groups by name, long active in mounting attacks in Kashmir. And for each we asked, when it has fought in occupied Kashmir, has it intentionally targeted civilians, or has it never done this? Only 6% viewed these groups as sometimes conducting attacks on civilian targets. About 40% believed they never do this, and there were no differences depending on which set of militants it was. Now, some militant groups also offer community services that meet some people's local needs. So are these kinds of services shaping a benevolent image of these groups in the public's mind? Naming some groups, we asked, do you think they provide social and community services, or are these not part of their activities? Only 23% thought they did. 42% thought they did not, and the rest presumably didn't know. So at the level of the public as a whole, these services are not having a strong echo. Taliban, Al-Qaeda, and domestic militant groups all seem to be increasingly using as a base the federally administered tribal areas, which has a special statute that keeps it outside Pakistan's mainstream. A primary question that gets too little attention is whether this special status itself is now outmoded. What do Pakistanis think about it? Well, we asked a complex question that offered three alternatives. A, the Frontier Crimes Regulation, the special statute, should be left unchanged. B, it should be modified slowly over time so that eventually the people there have the same rights and responsibilities as all other Pakistanis. C, it should be abolished for the same reason. Well, only 8% liked the status quo. A 46% plurality chose gradual change. Another 26% chose trying it at a single stroke. Altogether, you have 72% who wanted a new policy of integrating Fatah into Pakistan. So that's the larger picture, but how do Pakistanis think the government should try to handle Fatah under the current circumstances? Again, we offered three alternatives. A, the government should exert control there, even if that means using military force. B, the government should not try to exert control, but should try to keep the peace through negotiating deals with local Taliban. Or C, the government should withdraw its forces and leave the people alone. Less than a quarter thought control should be exerted by force. A 46% plurality wanted a process of deal-making, but only 12% thought the government and military should actually get out. So given this mix of views, it becomes pretty interesting whether the public approves of how Pakistan's government has in fact handled Fatah, since one could say actual policy has involved some force, some deal-making, and some retreating. And intriguingly, the government did not do that badly, with plurality approval from 48% of respondents. Not many would opt for the use of force, but might they see it as acceptable if it's an army decision? When asked about the Pakistani army entering Fatah, either to pursue Al-Qaeda or Taliban who've come in from Afghanistan, modest pluralities said they would favor this step, though over a third disagreed. But when the question is one of outside forces entering Pakistan on the same errands, the reaction was different, as it would be in many countries. So asked about whether Pakistan's government should give American or foreign troops permission to pursue the same groups, 4 out of 5 said no. Now in the West, it's conventionally accepted as a possibility that Osama bin Laden is somewhere in Pakistan's northwest, and this supposition tends to be key to the idea that U.S. forces might sometimes need to enter Pakistan in pursuit. We wondered whether this supposition had some acceptance in Pakistan as well. We asked which, just based on your impressions, you think is more likely to be true. We're hoping to encourage a guess. Bin Laden is somewhere in Pakistan, somewhere in Afghanistan, or in some other country. And most wouldn't play. Afghanistan was the most popular guess, followed by some other country. 8% volunteered, he's in the U.S. Only 2% said Pakistan. So this notion is quite firmly pushed away. In another effort, we tried a hypothetical question. Suppose the Pakistani government learned that Osama bin Laden was in Fatah and found his exact location. Do you think then that the government should or should not attempt to capture him? And a quarter thought that in that scenario, the government should try to capture him, but a 39% plurality thought it should not. So, though there's some slim support for strictly Pakistani military operations against these groups, it's quite limited. The most promising point, perhaps, in this complex problem is that Fatah's special status is not regarded well by the majority, and they would like to see it change. Now that we've gone through some of Pakistan's domestic concerns, we'll turn to its relations with the United States, and I'll conclude. A large majority view the U.S. as an untrustworthy superpower. 64% said they have not very much trust or none at all that the U.S. will act responsibly in the world. And this lack of trust is especially worrisome given that Pakistanis see the U.S. as very influential in their country's affairs. We asked respondents to think about all the recent major events happening in Pakistan and say, how much of these would you say are controlled by the U.S.? Only 26% thought that just some or very little of these events were controlled by the U.S. A 56% majority said that the U.S. controls most or nearly all of the major events that happen in Pakistan. We asked many questions about potential threats to Pakistan's vital interests. In fact, we asked 17 of these, but here was the one that came in the highest. 72% said the U.S. military presence in Asia was a critical threat to their country. 84% saw it as a threat. For the U.S. presence in Afghanistan, the results were nearly the same. This doesn't mean a majority of Pakistanis don't take into account the impact of 9/11 in this country and the basic goals of the war on terrorism. 63% said it was a U.S. goal to prevent more attacks such as those on the World Trade Center, and only 16% denied this. However, large majorities perceive other, more perfidious goals operating as well. 86% thought it was definitely or probably a U.S. goal to weaken and divide the Islamic world. We asked this same question in Pakistan in February 2007, and between February and September, this perception went up 13 points. We wondered if the Pakistani public saw any gains, major or minor, from their country's security cooperation with the U.S. We first asked, do you think the cooperation in the last few years on security and military matters has mostly benefited Pakistan, the United States, or both equally? 6% thought it had mostly benefited Pakistan. Another 12% thought the benefits had been equal. 44% thought it had mostly benefited the U.S. Another 11% volunteered that it had benefited neither. We then asked just those who had said this cooperation has mostly benefited the United States. Well, okay, do you think it's also helped Pakistan, or has it hurt Pakistan? And another 9% then said it's helped Pakistan, but 29% said it had hurt. So the internal constituency in the public for U.S.-Pakistan security cooperation is somewhere around a quarter of Pakistanis. Given these dim views of the U.S., it becomes interesting whether the public approve or not of the government's handling of relations with the U.S. And, in fact, a plurality disapproved, 47%, while a 39% minority did approve of the government's efforts. And here I'll stop. There's far more in the report, and now Steve is going to provide a different level of analysis.
Good afternoon. I'd like to take a few minutes to address the question of the significance of some of these findings for U.S. foreign policy. And first, I want to address a tendency that I see to approach events in the Muslim world through a kind of American lens or a unique narrative. And there's this tendency when there is conflict in the Muslim world to perceive it as on one side we have allies who are Western oriented and relatively secular, and they're in conflict with forces of militant Islamism, in many cases linked to Al-Qaeda. And this Western-oriented faction is a kind of bulwark against the onslaught of militant Islamism. But when we're talking about the Pakistani public, this narrative just really does not apply. In the Pakistani public, there is really no significant political constituency that is pro-Western and secular, including among the diehard supporters of President Musharraf. There is a small minority that is sympathetic to militant Islamists and Al-Qaeda, but it is not a significant political constituency, and it's by no means characteristic of the supporters of any of the major leaders, including Nawaz Sharif. And make this somewhat clear, I'm going to take you through a few of the slides that we saw earlier but this time broken out in terms of the various supporters of key leaders. We asked, who do you think would be the best person to lead Pakistan, and gave a few options. Of course, this was in September, and it was also, remember, the urban-only sample. However, when IRI did a urban and rural poll more recently, these numbers were almost exactly the same. So 27% endorse Benazir Bhutto, 21% Pervez Musharraf, 21% Nawaz Sharif, and then others were much lower. So we broke out a number of key questions in terms of the supporters of these groups, of these leaders. So first, looking at the support for a greater role for Islam. How important is it for you to live in a country that is governed according to Islamic principles? Overall, it was 9, Musharraf supporters 8.9, Bhutto supporters 8.8, Sharif supporters 9.0. No difference. And how much do you think Pakistan is governed according to Islamic principles? Basically, same kind of picture. Musharraf supporters a bit more positive than Sharif supporters, but in a fairly close range. As compared to current Pakistan law, do you think that Sharia should play a larger role, about the same, or a smaller role? And Musharraf supporters, the majority was a little bit lower, but it was still a majority among Musharraf supporters saying that they would like to see a larger role for Sharia. Do you think that the Pakistani security forces should have used force to take over the Red Mosque, or do you think it was a mistake? Well, here the Musharraf supporters were not as critical, but still you had 48% of them saying that it was a mistake, a plurality, as well as larger numbers among Bhutto supporters and Sharif supporters. That was one of the few cases where there was a really distinct difference between these groups. Now, looking at support for democracy and moderation, how important is it for you to live in a country that is governed by representatives elected by the people? And right down the line, high levels of support in, among all these political groups. How much you think Pakistan is governed by representatives elected by the people? Well, the Musharraf supporters are, again, a bit more approving, but not by much. The importance of the an independent judiciary, again, right down the line, very high levels of support and very consistent between these different groups. Views of Talibanization. Well, Musharraf supporters are, you get a larger number favoring a decrease as compared to Sharif supporters, but not a dramatic difference. The reform of the madrasas. Large majority supports right down the line. Also, there was a question about secularization that I didn't have made up here. And actually, the Musharraf supporters were more opposed to secularization than the Bhutto and Sharif supporters. Looking at Al-Qaeda, all groups perceive Al-Qaeda as a significant threat. Musharraf supporters were higher, but it applied to very much to Sharif supporters and Bhutto supporters as well. Turning to the mistrust of the U.S., all groups express lack of trust in the U.S. Musharraf supporters are not quite as mistrusting, but you still have a clear majority saying that they do not trust the U.S. to act responsibly. All groups, by a large margin, perceive the U.S. military presence in Asia as a threat. And perhaps most significantly, all groups, by a large margin, perceive that it is a goal of the United States to weaken and divide the Islamic world. And, of course, that needs to be connected back to the importance they place on having Islam play a larger role in their society. Finally, on a question that we didn't know would be quite so relevant when we wrote it, very large majorities of all groups reject the idea that the Pakistan government should allow U.S. troops to enter Pakistan to pursue and capture al-Qaeda fighters. So what we see here is some good news and some bad news. The good news is that this kind of upwelling of opposition to Musharraf and the intensification of opposition to the U.S., which has intensified, it does not appear to be rooted in some radical Islamist ideology. It has not, and it has not driven Pakistanis into the arms of Islamic militants. Support for democracy remains very strong, and indeed, one of the key things that brought about this shift was the treatment of the Supreme Court justice, which was seen as a contrary to democratic ideals related to an independent judiciary. Now, the bad news is there's also no faction within the within Pakistani political society that the U.S. can really turn to, that is sympathetic to it, and that can be used as a kind of base to work from. All of these factions perceive the United States as a threat. Even supporters of Musharraf have a very negative view of the U.S. and perceive it this way. So there's actually, it's somewhat paradoxical because we're seeing all this conflict, right? And yet, underneath, on some of these really very basic issues, there's a lot of commonality. And it's just a tendency when you see conflict to apply those models that we have of these key issues, but they are not very explanatory in understanding the nature of the conflict. Other factors are driving it. So the issues that are significant to the U.S. are not as key. It's not rooted in divisions about democracy, or it's not rooted in divisions on terms of views of the U.S. It's not even rooted in divisions about radical Islam, even though there are militant groups that are having a destabilizing effect that are playing an important role in the picture. In the broad scope, that is not a key factor. So if the U.S. does want to improve its relations with the Pakistani people, it's necessary for the U.S. to address the Pakistani people as a whole. There is no specific group that it can focus in on. It has to look at this totality and deal with a fairly broad consensus in favor of a fairly moderate form of Islam and form a relationship with that broad sensibility. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Well, I know there are a lot of people here. I just want to call your attention to the actual report. There are a number of subject areas which, for best utilization of time, we didn't cover here. I draw your attention to the discussion on education, that's the public school system, as well as the madrasas. So definitely flip through. If you have any questions about the report that were not necessarily addressed during the formal presentation, we're very happy to field those questions as well. There's a lot in there. You may not have had time to digest it. But I certainly don't want to waste your time by my blabbering on about the stuff that I found interesting in here, because I'm confident that some of these issues will come up in the Q&A. I do want to raise one issue, though, before yielding the floor to you. Many times when you see polls in Pakistan as well as in the Muslim world, but we saw this in the START survey, you have to be somewhat careful with questions like Sharia. Particularly in the Pakistani context, I have never seen people say, I don't want more Sharia, or I don't support Sharia. The question on its face is a little bit discomforting to its recipient. It's sort of like, are you still beating your wife? So in the polling context in Pakistan, when you see questions like that and you see high levels of support, you tend to see very little variation. And so very similar questions surrounding Islamic principles. You don't see a lot of variation. The answers always tend to be concentrated in the high levels of support category. So similarly, when we ask questions about secularization, I know some of you might be asking that question. I assure you, did not use the word secularization. We are well aware that in Urdu, secular really translates to without religion, even worse than atheism. Atheism implies or the theism. Be-Mazhab doesn't even imply that in Urdu. So while we didn't use that word, we did try to convey that there was a sense of personal piety being separate from the public sphere. And when you actually look at the data, you see that we still did not succeed in answering that question. I know over the weekend I fielded quite a bit of press calls about this notion of Talibanization. And to be clear, we threw that in there because at the time of doing the instrument or writing the instrument, as Clay pointed out, the Pakistani media was rife. Yet you see a lot of internal contradictions with the data surrounding that. So not exactly sure we can say what Talibanization. We discussed it amongst ourselves. Is it obscurantism, which required a run to the thesaurus? Is it militant Islam? So we're aware that some of these questions might strike you as kind of odd. But when we wrote the instrument, we were also aware that there had never really been a survey that tried to probe Pakistanis' views on the war on terrorism. And this, of course, has struck many of us in the Pakistan analytic community as sort of odd, that we have a relationship with this person and not the people. And yet we want the people to embrace this war on terrorism as their own, yet we really don't know what in the world they're thinking. So this was really, I would say, a test vehicle. We learned quite a bit from this, and if we get a chance to do it over, we would probably do things a little bit differently. So, for example, I'm fairly confident all those people who say they like Sharia would probably not be so enthusiastic had we asked, do you support having hands chopped off if your son gets caught shoplifting in the bazaar? Or do you support stoning adulterers to death? I'm fairly confident that though even those who said, yes, I want more Sharia, would probably not be too enthusiastic about those developments. So I want to let you know we are aware that some of these terms are difficult to parse, particularly when you're going from English to Urdu. And with those caveats, I'm going to open the floor to all of you folks for questions. I do ask, because there's so many of you, that we have these two microphones up here, and we're just going to take them side by side. So if that's okay? Yeah, there's the microphone is right here. We don't have anyone that can walk around to distribute it. So first come, first serve on the microphone. You got there first.
Okay, thank you. Raghubir Goyal.
And I had to say questions.
Yes, ma'am. Raghubir Goyal from India Globe and Asia Today. My question is that this is a great report. I'm sure it's going to help Mr. Musharraf a great deal. The question is that why billions of U.S. dollars have not, or it has increased the terrorism in Pakistan, or it has become a hub of terrorism? And second, you said that people-to-people contact. That means U.S. has made a mistake by supporting not the people of Pakistan, but General Musharraf then. And where do we go from here?
Well, I'll take a first shot at it. I'm not exactly sure that I agree with the full premise of your question. The question of whether or not terrorism is increased or not in Pakistan, I don't think is correlated to the aid portfolio. In fact, there are different kinds of terrorism in Pakistan, some of which have increased. Some kinds of terrorism emanating or militancy or insurgency emanating from Pakistan has decreased. Certainly the issues, the larger Pashtun militancy, Islamist militancy that's roiling the Pashtun areas is a complex mixture of Pakistani military operations there that weren't terribly successful, tended to use a number of military techniques that didn't produce their objective and alienated many people. It's complicated by what's happening across the border in Afghanistan. Some will also point to India's position in the region. So I certainly don't accept the premise that there's more terrorism as a consequence of U.S. aid. However, a number of people have raised the issue of the kind of aid that the U.S. has given, and I'm not sure that that is narrowly addressed by these data. I think what do come out of these data is that the United States has tended to focus on a person and an institution, and there are many allies we have in Pakistan on many of the issues that Clay and Steve addressed. But they also noted there are very large numbers, when you take it as a portion of 170 million or so living in Pakistan, that have views that are very disconcerting. Tazi, did you want to add anything to that?
First of all, I wanted to say how very much I appreciated this report, which has all kinds of fascinating material I will have to study at length. But I wondered whether you have anything approaching time series information for the questions about the prestige of the Army, because that 69% figure sits out there. You have to wonder what went before.
I'm not aware of any, do you?
Others have asked the same question, but I know that doesn't make it comparable.
No, I can't speak to that. I will look for more and try to get back to you.
Thanks, I'd appreciate it.
I mean, what we can say, there was the IRI question, but that's not strictly, and unfortunately our surveys were asked at different times, so we could not, sometimes we tried to ask the same question that Pew asked, but we didn't have the opportunity of piggybacking off of the IRI question. And to my knowledge, much of what's in this survey has never been asked before. We would love for those of you who have pocketbooks out there to do it again, to get a time series, because what Ambassador Schaefer just pointed out is critically important. You know, this is just a shot in time what people thought some afternoon in September. And the only way you can really get a sense of how important these findings are or not important is if we have them in a time series. So this is something that's very important. But for the most part, very few questions in here do they actually exist as time series.
Hi, Ivan Sigel. I'm a fellow here at USIP. I have a question about the sources of information that people receive their knowledge or public opinions. Did you ask or were you able to ask any questions such as what kind of media, what kind of sources of information people prefer, word of mouth, newspapers, international media, local media, and whether or not that might be controlling for certain kinds of public opinion or information? I've noticed that some of these questions have really huge disparities from, say, what American public opinion would be about, and others really feel much more like they're about domestic Pakistani issues, and I can sort of see where they're coming from, and others seem like a real miss. Thank you.
Well, I think the most important factor to talk about is the place of illiteracy in a sample like this in Pakistan. We asked each respondent, would you say that you can read with understanding in any language, and would you say that you can write with understanding in any language? 38% of our sample could say they cannot write in any language, and that's their self-declaration. That is, there may be some people who are uncomfortable with making that statement, or there are many degrees of being illiterate. But that means, first of all, that this is comparable to what you would see from the Pakistan Integrated Household Survey, and it means a great reliance on television and radio. Probably at the time that this was done, I do not think there were any serious controls on independent television in Pakistan in mid-September.
There weren't.
So I think you can assume that three and four or more of these people are getting whatever they know about public affairs from sources like TVs that they may not own, but they sometimes see in public locations.
Not in this study, but in the previous study that we did in Pakistan, we have extensive questions about people's sources of news, we can make that information available to you. There isn't anything really startling in it. People don't really know always where they get their information. You know, I mean, ask yourself, how do you know fact X? Well, you just know. I don't think you would find it highly revealing. Much more striking, of course, is the extent to which within Pakistani society you can have strong belief systems that are quite at odds with what you would find in the U.S., particularly in regard to, say, who was behind 9/11. Only what 3 or 4% of Pakistanis identified Al-Qaeda as behind it. And I had the pleasure of doing focus groups in Pakistan and pushing people on this, and they hold to this is not just something they say off the top of their head. They hold tenaciously to it, and you push them and you say, "Well, did you see Zawahiri? The video of Zawahiri? Oh, Hollywood can do anything." You know, it's just their ability just to repel ideas that are incompatible with those belief systems is quite striking. Another one that I find quite remarkable that again came out of the focus groups was the extent to which they describe things as caused by the U.S. And that's what prompted us to ask that rather odd question: how much of everything that's going on, all the important things that are going on, are controlled by the U.S.? And a majority said at least most, if not all. So it's this isn't exactly something you get from a news source. These are fundamental assumptions that are quite diffuse in society that shape the narrative.
My name is Zahid Bukhari from Georgetown University. One comment and question. Comment is, I would like to take exception with the Christian remarks about Sharia. Means that is the problem. I think reducing Sharia only to beating wife and...
You didn't understand. I want to intercept this because it was a fundamental misunderstanding. I said that asking that question in Pakistan produces very little observation. Very few people, and I've looked at many polls, say no. What I said was it's a loaded question akin to, and now looking back, it was probably not the best example, but it's a loaded question. It's the kind of question that very few people would say no to. And part of it, I think, is the context of it. Some guy comes knocking, or a gal, comes knocking on your door, and you don't know that person. They say they're from E.C. Nielsen, but maybe they're not. And they're asking a question that is actually somewhat sensitive. So I think what you find in the Pakistan survey data, it happened with START, the stuff you did with START last year, it happened here. You see very high don't know, refuse rates. And, you know, on average, it's like 20% of people simply opted out of the question. And for more sensitive questions, it goes up to 40%. So I wanted to intercept you. I wasn't in any way, shape, or form relating Sharia to domestic violence. But what I was trying to say is, That's a joke in the United States. You're still beating your wife. But it's a loaded question that tends to not produce variation. And when you have a question that produces no variation across a wide range of demographics, I often wonder, what do I do with that question? How do I interpret it? And that was what I was trying to suggest.
Why I'm saying that it's not only Sharia. I think the stereotyping of Sharia, jihad, and madrasa It's not. I'm not talking about the Pakistan. I'm talking here in the Western scholars and policymakers. That's stereotyping. To some extent, same stereotyping. If you ask in Pakistan, Western democracy means vulgarity. So that stereotyping should not be done. And that's the other way with Sharia reducing or jihad reducing to terrorism. That's also problematic. But that's a comment. That's another debate.
You understand we didn't do that. We're simply saying I understand,
but when you make that comment. But that's fine. Wonderful. But the question is, it's a wonderful survey. Very good. But what is Steve and Clay both, Krishna also, what are the major flaws of American policymakers right now, what they are doing? If you can explain to us, according to your survey, what they are doing to Pakistan right now. And one question, but instead of promoting the Western notion of democracy and so-called liberal and secular, isn't it possible to promote Islamic democracy in the Muslim world?
Well, I think that's, in a way, the key point is that is really what Pakistani people want, and there is a perception that the United States is seeking to undermine Islam, and one that we didn't explore so much here, but that comes through another polling, is that the perception that the United States is hypocritical, that it doesn't follow through on its principles, and those perceptions that the U.S. doesn't consistently support democracy and that it is actually out to undermine Islam and that it constitutes a threat. These are fundamental problems for the U.S. to deal with. What should the U.S. do about them? I mean, that's another big subject. And what are the trade-offs when we try to offset those perceptions by other actions, and what are the costs of those actions? That's a big calculation that somebody needs to make. But clearly what we see here is that in terms of public diplomacy, the U.S. has a significant problem vis-a-vis the Pakistanis. Now, there are other signs, though. Compared to other Muslim countries, the Pakistanis are not the most virulently anti-American. And there are some questions where they say, well, you know, they have kind of more mixed views. Going back to the focus groups, the same person will at one moment express tremendous negativity toward the U.S. and then also express positive attitudes about a lot in the U.S. And in fact, in the focus group, the thing that people said the most were complaints about immigration. You know, that they were offended that after all that we have sort of done for you, kind of accommodated your foreign policy goals, you're not allowing us to have full access to the country, which it has a sort of underlying friendly tone to it. So the anger, the virulence that comes through in some questions. You know, there are other questions where you can see that some kind of rapport and the two can in a sense enhance each other.
But actually, he raised an interesting point, and this is about the facile assumption that if you support Sharia, you're anti-democracy. I fielded several questions from media about this yesterday. It's so unfortunate that you misunderstood my comment about that term, because we're actually in very much in agreement. When people saw these results about Sharia, they immediately assumed that those people were hostile to democracy. I've been going to Pakistan since 1991. And I think for many people, Sharia and Islam is inherently democratic. And so for people who would say that they would support Sharia, there's absolutely no contradiction with also supporting democracy. Similarly, in other questions that we asked that weren't formally presented, there are other aspects of Sharia that has to be seen in the context of Pakistan. So, for example, when we were having discussions about Talibanization, we didn't ask formally any questions about this in the survey, but there had been discussions about what do people support, for those people who support Talibanization, what are they supporting? Well, one of the things that they do in FATA, and the same thing is under the Frontier Crimes Regulation, they have expeditious justice. You may not like the terms of the justice, but try to get a case pursued in the Pakistani justice system, the formal court system, and justice will be delayed, deferred, and probably ultimately denied. So I really encourage you, when you look at the data, to not assume that support for Sharia is somehow antithetical to democracy. I also want to raise the issue of democracy being a Western concept. There's nothing in the survey that stated anything. It was a very straightforward question. Do you believe that your government should be ruled by elected representatives? So there was nothing in particular that said a particular kind of democracy or another. But I want to emphasize, you can support Sharia and support democracy, that in the Pakistani context, there's nothing antithetical about those two things. Does that address the concerns that you had?
So when an American policy also to support Islamic democracy?
Well, look. We're talking about the survey, but I think what does come out of the survey is that there's, we've all been followers of Pakistan. I've had to take various phone calls the last couple of weeks, and everyone questions, do Pakistanis want democracy? That was the question that came up yesterday repeatedly, and I think the survey undeniably says yes. People in the cities want democracy. And so there is a question of how can you support one person against a country? So I think in those terms, the survey, does speak to that issue.
And support for Sharia and support for democracy are positively correlated. People who support Sharia are more supportive of democracy than others.
I think.
Yeah. Imran Siddiqui, Urdu TV, Voice of America. Fascinating survey. There's a growing dilemma in Pakistan, in the rural Pakistan and urban Pakistan, when it comes to differentiating between the U.S. government and the people of the United States. Was there any specific question with reference to that? Because when you say they hate U.S., what do you actually mean by that? Because it's highly relevant, keeping in perspective the State Department's travel policies. Was there any specific question that would create a difference between the people and because people have to understand more than 50% people came out against President Bush.
Mm-hmm. Yes, definitely. In this current study, all of our questions that were asked about the U.S. were really about U.S. policy. In the previous study that Chris has referred to that we did with START with the University of Maryland, we did ask Pakistanis about whether they had a favorable attitude towards the U.S., the American people, American culture, and American laws on freedom of expression. And there is a lot of variance, and there is a lot more favorability toward the American people than toward the U.S. without any other qualification.
So in this particular question, I saw a question that said, are you anti-U.S.? something like that. What did they mean by that? Were they referring to the policies of the present government or to the overall American population?
I'm really not sure what question you're referring to. The strongest one, perhaps, is when they're asked to assess various possible threats to Pakistan, they regard the U.S. military presence in the region and in Afghanistan as a large majority regards that as a really critical threat to Pakistan.
Do you think
that's really the thrust of it in this study?
Do you think I could report right now? I'm going to cut live right now. Do you think I can say that this survey proves that people are not against Americans in Pakistan? Would it be safe to say that? Because I mean, I'm
cut
concerned.
Live. First of all, it's not in this in this study that distinction wasn't made, but the primary. The intense negative feeling is definitely focused on the U.S. government.
Thank God.
When asked about the U.S. people or aspects of U.S. culture, it's not predominantly positive, but it's much more, the negativity is much more moderate. So you can't go out there and say the Pakistani people love the American people, no.
And State Department would allow them to travel to Pakistan without any travel advisory. I mean, you didn't get killed, you came back alive, so that's a good sign.
That's a little bit, if you want, because this is really beyond the scope of this survey, and there's lots of people behind you.
Thank you so much for your time.
Yeah, we can get you, though, we can get you the START survey, if that would be helpful.
Okay. The inconsistency among democratization, independent courts, and Sharia law. I think you've answered my question, but I would like to probe a little bit further. In the Pakistani context, is it possible that their definition of democracy and increase in Sharia law could encompass religious courts, similar to Iran, which would override the courts, the secular courts? Is that possible? Do you have any feel for that?
You want to talk about the existing setup?
This is really pushing beyond this survey.
I understand that.
But I think, you know, if we were to redo this survey, you know, inshallah in the future, I would want to probe. By the way, there's another concept that I have a lot of discomfort with is globalization. Folks, you know, will give an opinion about globalization, and then they'll subsequently answer. Those who say they support globalization will give answers that actually don't support lineaments of globalization. So if we were to do this again, like I said, we test drove a couple of questions. I'd like to do a battery about what Sharia means to you. Do you support religious courts for family matters, for families for matters outside of the family? I don't think we're really able to answer that question here, but it's something.
Actually, we do have something.
In which regard?
That would have taken too much time.
Oh, this is about the
we
recourse.
We ask respondents suppose you or your family was a victim of a crime. Where would you prefer to turn? And we gave them a lot of different options. And about 8, and some of these fall into a religious or quasi-religious category. But the courts, the regular courts, was the most popular response. 34% said that.
Do we know that it's regular courts? That's why I was hesitant to go there.
It's page 11. Then the next most frequent was my family or clan, so that you would start at home.
Hold on, Clay. Yes. It just says judiciary or courts. We actually can't say what kind of court it is. That's why I was hesitant to invoke this. But 1 in 3 did say judiciary or courts. We just can't say which kind of court it is. Because there is Sharia courts.
Okay.
So that's why I was hesitant to bring that, because I didn't know that we had specified what kind of court it was.
All right.
Okay.
Yeah, sorry.
It's coming.
Yeah.
Watch this space. We are going. Those questions are
going
to be asked.
We're learning.
Okay. I'm Diane Perlman. I'm a social scientist studying cycles of violence, terrorism, and nuclear proliferation. First of all, thank you very much for this, and very much needed to correct misperceptions. On Saturday night, in a Democratic candidate forum, Barack Obama, who could very well be our next president, said that he would take unilateral military action in Pakistan if there were actionable intelligence. and the other candidates sort of felt either went along with it, and you're making anyway.
I'm nearsighted.
Okay. Felt I guess required to go along with that, and I've also gotten some emails today that there may be some movements towards preparing for military action in Afghanistan. So anyway, given your results of your study, and obviously it would provoke a huge amount of negative reaction and validate their fears against us, probably increased recruitment, maybe more terrorist attacks. So a two-part question. One is, what do you think would happen if we did that? But more importantly, to what extent is your study, or do you have channels advising Congress people, candidate, people in power about this? Because there's sort of a focus on our own security needs without being aware of how we affect security needs of other, and sort of a short-term concrete thinking about going after bad guys without deeply considering escalation of cycles of violence and having the opposite effect that might be intended.
Well, and beyond what we presented about U.S. antipathy, we already have done that. And, for example, the strike in Bajor is what precipitated suicide strikes in Fatah, a whole new innovation of suicide strikes in Pakistan. Bajor, in 2006, January, the U.S. did launch a missile strike on some targets trying to get a number of high-value targets. They failed. And then, again, in October, there was a missile strike on a madrasa. One of the consequences, we can't draw a correlation, but one of the transformations of the conflict that ensued was shortly thereafter, militant groups for the first time in Pakistan's history began using suicide attacks against Pakistani armed forces in the federally administered tribal areas called Fatah. But I think I'm going to, there have been now a couple of years of things that we can observe where there's been an action, there's been a reaction. Now, whether or not there's causality, one can't say that. But I think turning to the lineaments of the survey, I'm going to turn to Clay and to Steve about that. If you have something, I presume you have something to say.
Well, it's very clear that the cost would be very high. I think it's very simple. That people would find it very offensive to their sense of national sovereignty. It would enhance the sense, which I think we'd probably find hard to understand, that the U.S. threatens them. Recall that question about U.S. military presence in Asia, U.S. military presence in Afghanistan. Very large majority say we perceive that as a major threat to Pakistan. And so if the U.S. penetrated Pakistan, even with government approval, it would still be perceived as a violation of Pakistani national sovereignty,
and the
political costs would be very high.
Let me note that what we did ask them was, do you think that the Pakistani government should approve or allow U.S. forces to do this? And so what 80% of them said no to is the government of Pakistan giving this permission. So if there's a step where the Pakistani government then turns to its public and says, we weren't asked permission, you can imagine, I think.
And well, what about the second part? Can you directly communicate with Obama or with the campaigns and give them feedback?
Beyond the scope of the survey.
Good afternoon. Thank you for your report. I'm Josephine Squires, and I'm a political scientist living in Kansas. I just happened to be here at the moment and wanted to come to one of your talks. Given the history of Pakistan and the main reason for its formation, actually, it's not at all surprising that there's a very strong Muslim identity there, right? And so I would think that the antipathy towards the USA is rooted largely, at least, in some sort of protectiveness towards this Muslim / Pakistani identity, right? So I know we've alluded to this before. So I have a question, then I have a suggestion. My question is, do you know of any efforts that might have been made to show some proactive support for this identity, you know, not the criticism of it all the time, support for it. And would you consider in one of your later surveys perhaps including some open-ended questions on, you know, what might change the attitudes towards the U.S.? Because that's the way you can sort of get some rapprochement, if you would, in that sense.
It's hard, though, with 900 families.
Yeah.
to do
the
that
themes here. That do come through spontaneously in focus groups, and we've also done open-ended questions over the internet with other groups. The key theme you hear a lot is respect, and the perception that the U.S. doesn't respect Pakistanis, doesn't respect Islam, doesn't, and that it's sort of a mix of race and religion and so on. In this survey, we even asked whether there's a perception that the U.S. is trying to spread Christianity in the region. Mm-hmm. A majority believes that that is a goal of the United States, to spread Christianity. I don't think this is probably the place for us to develop specific ideas, but I think that the theme comes through rather clearly. That deep in their hearts, Americans just want to convert, want to eradicate Islam, mm-hmm. and that is a fundamental perception that needs to be addressed.
Well, there are two policy questions that I've sort of looked at recently, where this has kind of become my windmill. I've done quite a bit of work on madrasa reform, mm-hmm. and. When you look at, and not just this survey, the Herald did a survey a number of years back. There's, you know, a number of surveys that show that Pakistanis do support madrasa reform. So madrasa reform was actually, the process of that began long before 9/11. When the United States began talking about madrasa reform, it sort of muddied the waters. And it sort of undercut those folks within the Islamist or the religious education sector that were promoting reform for their own purposes. When I spoke with educators in madrasas, they said, of course we support reform, reform for our purposes. We want to have an educational system that produces ulama that make judgments relevant to a modern state of Pakistan. Mm-hmm. So this was an area where every time I heard a U.S. official go off about madrasas, I just cringed, because we were actually undermining mm-hmm. the forces of reform that were trying to push this issue. On a related issue has been education reform. The U.S. put $100 million towards education reform, focusing on curriculum. And this was another area that, while I support in general the principle of education reform, the language in which it was couched was very alienating. The work that we did here, some of the work I did in the course of the madrasa study, Matt Nelson's work at SOAS, and a number of others, come to a striking conclusion that Pakistanis have a taste for religious education, even in their public schools. And so when there's a U.S. program on the table that explicitly talks about secularizing the curriculum, this is a non-starter. So mm-hmm. I think that there's this idea that folks want a secular education over something else, and that by building schools that do this, they will come, may not be a wise approach forward. So I think there are a number of areas where we would be behooved to recognize Pakistani preferences. First, we have to know what their preferences are. And to my knowledge, this is the first study in that direction to understand Pakistani preferences. And that's mm-hmm. the first step towards respecting them as we forge policy.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Alex Thier from the U.S. Institute of Peace, and it's great to have these survey results as all of us cast a eye over the worrying events in Pakistan, particularly after the survey was completed. And to that end, I wanted to ask you if you could to unpack a little bit this question about the perceived threats, because there's a couple things that I find kind of fascinating about it. It's on page 22. And as you noted, you asked about 17 different threats. It's pretty striking to notice that of 13 of those threats that you presumably identified were listed as critical or important threats. So one question that I have is a sort of general pollster type question. Is it striking to you that there are so many things on this list, or is it the problem of asking the question that you get an answer? In other words, it's pretty striking to me that Pakistanis are worried about 13 really important or critical threats to the integrity of their country. And part of the reason I'm asking that is obviously as instability increases in Pakistan with the assassination, it seems like a number of these forces potentially could interact with each other to create in the minds of people in Pakistan a tremendous sense of instability. That all of these threats, it's not, well, I'm worried about this one this week. A lot of these actually come together, particularly at a moment of crisis. And so my concern is, what can you glean from this in terms of how unstable Pakistanis actually believe the country is as a whole, as these threats present themselves? Do you think that in your experience as pollsters, you can actually say something about how they're perceiving these threats and whether the sheer number of these threats does indicate some sense in Pakistan that things could really fall apart?
Well, first of all, just the international comparative side. That is, the Chicago Council for Global Affairs asks a very similar long string of possible threats to the U.S. Every couple of years. And if you stack them all up, they may not look quite as alarming as this, but a lot of that is in the eye of the beholder. You would have a good many people in American results that would say a threat is important but not critical. Consequently, you could build a table that looked something like this. And then, second, we wanted to do this because, if I understand correctly, one longtime concern of observers of Pakistan is that Pakistan may sense existential threat for a lot of very clear-cut geopolitical reasons, and that those could throw off its calculations, and maybe you could pick it up from there.
Yeah, I mean, this is a collaborative effort, so reflecting PIPA's interest and USIP's interest back when I was a USIP person. I was very interested in these questions of the militant groups, in part because when we talk about militant groups in Pakistan, we tend to just talk about them as one smear. And it seemed reasonable enough to me that a person may support Jaish-e-Mohammed, but they may not, which is a group active in Kashmir, but they may find the activities of Lashkar-e-Jhangvi, which goes around killing Shia, to be repugnant. And so if you're thinking about campaigns that might be able to discourage support for terrorism or militancy or insurgency, you have to sort of understand who's supporting these different groups with much more nuance. So I can tell you this much. We've already begun doing some of the econometric analyses with a colleague out at Stanford. And I wanted to know, are people distinguishing across these different militant groups? You could have two hypotheses. One is, you have a taste for militancy. If you like this kind of militant, if you like ice cream, you might like that kind of ice cream too. Or alternatively, you might like only one kind. So what we did find is that Pakistanis, if you look at if we asked about Al-Qaeda, local Taliban, and Fatah, the Askari Tanzims, the Muhajirs, the Sindhis, and the Baluch, what you actually see is that they are fanning out their preferences. They are actually distinguishing. They have very clear preferences. Now, it is the case, this was kind of an interesting finding. If you're not worried about Al-Qaeda, you're not worried about anything else. And that's really true. The people who said, I'm not worried about Al-Qaeda, didn't give a darn about anything else either in the threat perception. So the militant threat perception. So one of the reasons why we did this is that we were trying to look at very specific issues and trying to understand, if you believe that Shia are a threat in your country, does that then correlate to your not believing that, you know, Sipe Sabe Pakistan is a threat? So part of these are sort of an analytical exercise, the utility of which will become more apparent as we do the secondary analysis.
You're disaggregating that based on geographic data?
We have a number of hypotheses, and we've got other variables that are not in here. But yeah, we're going to do a lot more sexy stuff with these data that will allow us to sort of figure out who is supporting different militant groups. And one of the predictors that we were hoping would be, you know, we asked the question about how guided by Islamic principles should Pakistan be versus how much is it actually being guided by those principles. So we were looking to see if there's a dissatisfaction variable that might predict some of these issues. So we're still going through the data and playing with it, but before ISA comes around, we'll have an interesting analysis, I hope, of who supports terrorism and why across these different groups.
Let me just quickly answer, though. I would say no. This doesn't necessarily indicate that the Pakistanis think that their country is in dire straits. These kinds of findings are not don't point to that. You could find these in all kinds of countries. What these kinds of scales show you is what's higher and what's lower. And I think it's very striking that U.S. military presence is at the top and that Al-Qaeda is in the middle and more homegrown ones are lower down, militant groups are lower down. And so how they prioritize is key. And then also when you do this over time, you can see what goes up and what goes down. But the whole subject of how people relate to scales is to some extent cultural, and there's more to say than you want to hear right now.
Yes, my name is Alev Akbulut. I'm an alumni of Western Michigan University. I guess, first of all, I want to mention that the result of this survey shouldn't actually hopefully be a surprise to most of us if you understand the Middle East. I mean, it's not that much of a surprise to me. But what I'm worried about is actually, first of all, we have to be kind of careful what the survey means because there are cultural differences. This survey was conducted from an English-American, or language perspective, so to say. So we have to keep that in mind. This is not a survey from a Pakistani perspective, and I think there's probably some cultural and language differences, and I'm not sure. So I guess my question is, how do you interpret the result of this survey, and what kind of policy changes would you suggest? Because I see a lot of opportunity. If I'm not sure whether you're interpreting the survey the way I do, but I think there's a lot of opportunity for policy change and to turn things into a very positive direction. Do you see that opportunity as well?
I just want to make some clarification on the first points. In case it's not completely clear, the people who went and did these interviews were not Americans.
We're not us.
They were local Pakistanis, naturally speaking the
But it's an American version. Survey, right? I mean, put the survey together,
developed
right?
The questions, yes.
Yes, that's what I meant.
The people who were being interviewed had no, you know, there was an interviewer that came
to
their door,
and
it's probably somebody in their community, and probably sat down and had tea with them and things like that. So, as far as translation issues, we have involved many in the course of developing various questions. We've been doing quite a lot of polling in these countries. We have gotten local people participating and giving us feedback on the questionnaire and translating and back translating all kinds of things. So we try to sort out any complexities or distortions that would come from the way that we might formulate the idea on the first round.
Okay. So any?
Yeah.
Yes. And. One of the reasons we do focus groups is to hear how people articulate ideas, and we even systematically had people write things out that became phrases that we then incorporated into other poll questions and things like that.
Okay. So how do you interpret this, and what kind of policy changes would you suggest? What does this mean to you?
Held forth a bit on that when I was standing up there and emphasizing the need to relate to the moderate Islamic middle, that I think for many people the notion of you know, Islam or Islamism or Sharia and democracy, you know, like that's a Zen koan, you know, you can't hold those two ideas in your head at the same time. Pakistani people are, and an effective policy will relate to Pakistanis in a way that recognizes both of those aspects. I just also wanted to add one thing about Sharia, because that's come up a few times. I think if you ask the average Pakistani, what does Sharia mean, you would more apt to get an answer like taking care of the poor, you know, being kind, being generally pious, helping your neighbor, Those are the themes that come through the strongest. And if you said something about, you know, chopping off a hand, they would probably fall back and, what are you talking about? It's just, so this word has become to be, you know, have a sort of loaded meaning in the West that I think is quite inconsistent with the way it is in Pakistan. But do you want anything on the policy front?
We've been talking about that for the last hour and a half. I don't have anything to add other than what we've already said. I just don't.
I mean, you can't take this poll and say, okay, this means that this is what the policy should be. What it tells you, like, it says that if you go into the Fatah area and go after al-Qaeda, the costs will be high. Does it say you shouldn't do it? You should do it. I mean, you have to make that, you know, policymaker has to make that calculation, but it tells us the costs are high. It tells us that our military presence in the region is perceived as a threat. And not there to help them, but it threatens them, it intimidates them, therefore the cost is high. These things have to be, and that when those presences are integrated into a narrative that is, you know, an overarching narrative of this, that the U.S. is hostile, then they become even more inflammatory. That there is support for democratic principles, and if anything, the support for democratic principles is a source of frustration with the U.S., that the U.S. is not perceived as being consistently supportive of those principles, as the way the U.S. has conducted policy in Pakistan isn't perceived as truly consistent with the democratic ideals. Does that mean here's where our policy ought to change? Well, that, I can't say that, but it certainly gives us much more information from which we can decide.
I'm Howard Schaefer, Georgetown University. A great deal is appearing in the press these days about regional and ethnic differences within Pakistan. And I was wondering, I recognize that you have a relatively small sample, whether you were able to identify any meaningful statistical information that would suggest differences between or among regions and ethnic groups.
I've been waiting for you, sir. This
glad
morning
to help out.
I broke out about 40 questions by the four provinces. The sample is large enough that you can look at Punjab and Sindh and get a really good sense. Northwest Frontier Province, it's very iffy, but if they're extremely different, that's a value. Baluchistan is just too small in our sample. Overall, the similarities exceed the differences. You don't look at this and say, oh, this is a country about to fly apart at all. I'd be happy to go through it in more detail with you afterward. One thing that struck me was that Musharraf, in fact, seemed to have, if I recall correctly, less support in Punjab than Sharif does in our poll. So that's a sample.
But on the more general questions?
On the more general the question, the less difference I saw. Mm-hmm. And the questions about the United States is where I saw the least difference.
Thank you.
My name is Mumtaz Khan. I'm from International Kashmir Alliance. And my question, I have a brief comment in terms of the strong sense of the Islamic identity we are talking in Pakistan. It's probably the product of the military rule in Pakistan, where the regional identities are stronger than the Pakistani identity. What the military has done during this period to marginalize those regional identities, because most of the region or provinces are dissatisfied with the present arrangements within Pakistan. So they have encouraged the religious forces to marginalize the nationalist forces in Pakistan, and also to the democratic forces to marginalize democratic forces to create the justification for the military rule in Pakistan. That has helped to create this kind of Islamic identity or sense of
We need you to ask a question because there's lots of people left and there are 10 minutes, not speechifying. So what's your question? Hit the question.
No, because we are talking about the Islamic identity there and the, I mean, Sharia there, because the level of understanding, we should understand the people of Pakistan.
We do, but we need you to ask a question.
Understand what the Sharia is. I mean, because they just only read and write. That is the meaning of the literacy there. So my point is that the opposition to the U.S. policy, why the Pakistani people are against the U.S. policies, because the U.S. is supporting probably the not supporting the democracy or not supporting the public opinion there and just supporting the military dictator.
We understand that.
Would be that reason?
If you have a question, get to it, but we've got lots of people.
Everything has to be understood in the context that Pakistanis perceive that the U.S. has extraordinary power over everything that's happening. And so if anything that's happening, the default position is, I wonder why the U.S. is trying to do that. That is the starting point. So whatever their situation is, you know, it's to some extent the fault of the U.S. It takes active information to change that. And I think if we hold that and see events that have been unfolding recently, and that the U.S. is that those events are attributed to the U.S. Whatever the administration spokespeople get up and say, that is how it starts, and that's why. In that context, it's not very hard for us to understand why the U.S. is not perceived as consistently supporting democracy.
Yes, my name is Manuel Lagari. I'm with the World Sindhi Institute. My question is a very easy question. These 19 cities you select in whole Pakistan, I want to hear that from Punjab, how many cities you selected, from Sindh, from Balochistan, from Northwest Frontier Province. And I have also a suggestion. I would really appreciate if USIP do in 39 villages that after Benazir Bhutto, either peoples of Pakistan, especially Sindh and Balochistan, do they like to stay in Pakistan or do they like to be separate from the Pakistan?
I'd like to defer your question until we're done, and if you'll come up, then I will then show you the list of the 19 cities, and you will be able to spot their location in Pakistan much more rapidly than I.
Hi, John Burnham from National War College. Two questions on U.S. military presence and operations there in country. The first, you talked about approving U.S. operations and obviously the high level of disapproval. Did you all talk at all about expanding U.S. PAC acknowledged operations, combined operations, sort of getting back to the mill-to-mill relationships that we had in times previous, so it wasn't so much a unilateral piece as it would be a combined Pakistani-U.S. operation? The follow-on to that is the perception of U.S. presence in the region as a threat. With things like the earthquake relief in Pakistan, and the tsunami relief, you know, largely used military logistics and medical support and everything. Did that have any kind of an effect on folks' perception? I mean, there's going after high-value targets, and then there's the humanitarian piece. Did you all unpack that at all, or is it just kind of one big aggregate U.S. military presence as a threat? Thanks.
First of all, on the question of bilateral military operations, we don't have anything that specifically addresses that. Pardon?
We can just have security guarantees.
There has been evidence in past polling, this study can't cover that, but there has been evidence in past polling that active disaster relief by the United States is good for people's perception of Americans. It tends to not be it doesn't create a permanent condition.
I would also add that the polling that has been done by IRI found in about 9 months ago a plurality approving of cooperation in the war on terror. Long around March that shifted, and now you have a strong majority against cooperation in the war on terror. So there is definitely the potential for Pakistanis to think in terms of the threats associated with Al-Qaeda and other groups, and to think, well, yeah, the U.S. is something of a partner in that. I sometimes use the analogy that it's like they're living in a situation where there are different warlords operating in their space, and they don't necessarily like either one of them very much, right? But if one of them becomes, the threat from one becomes more salient, then they might get more friendly with the one that might offset it and see the benefit of that. But at the moment, the threat associated with the U.S. is greater than the threat that's associated with Al-Qaeda. And that's a problematic situation for the U.S.
Commander Bill Warwick, Shireen Berkey. I'm here from Quantico Marine Corps. First, a very quick comment. Maybe perhaps in your follow-up, you'll have more nuanced questions, less generic questions to obtain more nuanced answers. And any particular reason why you didn't focus on the rural areas? One question. The other was, what was the male-female ratio of the participants? How did you select the participants for this, to answer the questions? What is the percentage of your sample size from the four provinces? Why you ignored Fatah? And I have a lot of language of the questionnaire. Was it in the regional languages, or was it all in Urdu? Because that tells me a lot about the responses that you obtained. Whether it
okay.
was.
Yes. I'm going to ask our associate. This is Evan Lewis, yes. And I'll just one after the other. The first one was
of,
the rural
the
urban.
Percentages come to me afterwards.
Okay.
That would be a really
one. So, one question. Why did you only focus on the urban?
It's very
that's
easy.
Well,
there's also a realistic answer. I was the contracting officer while at USIP, right. And here's a fact. It's very expensive to do polling in rural areas. It's not linear. It scales up exponentially. And as Clay, I believe, noted earlier, when one of the biggest predictors of whether or not you have a don't know or a refuser is illiteracy. So when you've got high areas of illiteracy, it's going to produce relatively incoherent data at high cost. And we did this on $35,000. So we can come up with all kinds of technical answers to answer your question, but I'm going to give you the real answer. We had $35,000, and that buys an urban sample.
But let me add to that, though.
That said, however, we did an analysis of our national sample from our previous START study and found that the directionality of answers was no different between the national and the urban sample. The directionality was not, and the don't knows were highly influential, and so
just to clarify, directionality means the majority feels one way or the other way. Once you factor out the DKs, but in our last study, we had an urban and rural sample, and the don't knows are so high in the rural sample, we just put it aside and did the analysis on the other of the urban sample.
Did you revisit your questions, perhaps?
Sorry?
And rephrase them?
Absolutely. This survey built off of theirs. So they had a great instrument in four countries. We tried to tailor this to Pakistan. That's exactly what we did. I mean, I think this was the point of this effort, but we have to be honest about the modesty of the money that we had
to
play with.
$35,000 is a drop in the bucket.
So not quite. It's off by 2%. I say 49 women, 51 male, but it's as close as you can get.
Pretty close.
And language, Urdu?
Oh, Urdu.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, you know, people may not read Urdu, but the instrument was in Urdu. But in Pakistan, as you know, you may not read, this was a verbally administered, you may not read or write Urdu, but you recognize Urdu and you can answer a question. So, especially in urban areas. So that for when you take out the rural sample, this was a verbally administered survey.
Karen Walker, University of Maryland, and I'm in the communication department. But we had another demographic sample question, whether you were able to separate like older adults from younger adults to assess whether there might be an intergenerational difference, particularly in the bilateral relations and bilateral economic relations with the U.S.
Edmund, you have an answer on that?
We haven't done that particular analysis and looking at the different groups. It's something that we could do. The sample was more heavily weighted towards young people than old people, reflecting the population demographics in the country.
Thank you.
Hi, Sonia from the LA Times. Page 21, some of the most, I thought, neuralgic data for American policymakers. Okay, we know relations between Afghanistan and Pakistan are bad, but could you just from the focus groups try to explain? 34% said the former Taliban government was the best approach to governing Afghanistan, kind of, you know, for the Western narrative, the worst government in the world gets 34% popularity rating. And then also further down, when you have the perception that, again, you know, not new, but that the Pakistan people think the Afghans aren't really trying. And can you explain from the focus groups, you contrast that with the perception of the U.S. military threat. So if the Afghans aren't trying and the U.S. military are, then why is the U.S. such a big threat? Can you just unpack that for us?
Those are a fair number. I don't know if I can hit them all. I've been curious about the low level of confidence in the Afghan government, but you know the Karzai government certainly has its problems, and there's if you're talking to Russians and they say you know. Yeah, well, when Stalin was in charge, you know, things got done, you know, and Mussolini in Italy made the trains run on time and stuff. So you can get those kinds of sentiments, and it doesn't necessarily mean, you know, I want that kind of thing here. I think the fact that such small numbers favored increased Talibanization is really your most important read. So it was a comparative question, and it's more of an expression of lack of confidence in the Karzai government than anything else.
The question is not even answered by half of the respondents as well.
I'm not sure. What was the second question? I wasn't holding them all in my mind. About the relative threat.
Well, right, if the Afghan government isn't trying, and that's perceived as bad thing, and then the U.S. military force is trying, and that's also perceived as a threat. So what is it that Pakistan is wanting with the last question?
They probably would like an Afghan government that stabilizes the situation so that the people, the Taliban forces are not going back and forth across the border and into the Fateh area and generating a lot of instability for them. And so that, to me, is quite distinct from their attitudes about the United States, which you know, have a long history. The complexity of it is, just to tell a quick little story, there was one particular woman who was railing on and on and on, you know, about against the U.S., right, and saying positive things about bin Laden, sort of in defiance, you know. And I said, so what do you think the U.S. ought to do? Oh, I think the U.S. ought to make Pakistan the 51st state. Let's get it over with. So it's a... You have to understand that the feelings for the U.S. are so, you know, try to think of ancient Rome, right? And they're in the outpost, and they perceive that Washington is like Rome to them. The U.S. is so powerful, and that bothers them. And they feel threatened by it. At the same time, they want things from it, you know, and they like when they get some things from it. And so I don't think there's any comparison to what how they perceive it.
Chris.
Yeah, I mean, I actually have a couple of different thoughts about the Pakistani antipathy towards Karzai. You know, many Pakistanis, this is just from hanging out, and I don't think this poll addresses it per se. We did have some questions about the Durand Line. Very few people, if I recall correctly, knew what the Durand Line was. So we did try to unpack what the deal was between they recognized that Pakistan-Afghanistan relations were problematic, but when we went through what seemed obvious to us, you know, the Durand Line, you know, the disputed border that Afghanistan doesn't want to acknowledge, the claims that many Afghans will make on Pakistani territory, few people knew what the Durand Line was. A few people were even cognizant that Afghan officials were making those claims. So it's kind of difficult to unpack. The questions that we had didn't shed much light. But there is a lot of distrust about the nature and the composition of Karzai's government. There's always back and forth between Musharraf and Karzai, which, like, you know, this irritating thing that they describe with a more irritating term, the blame game. So I think Pakistanis who watch the news do see that Karzai is all the time blaming Musharraf for the insurgency problem. At the same time, they hear Musharraf, in fact, saying, no, you've got your Taliban. It's like the horrible Reese's peanut butter commercial from our youth. You've got your Taliban in our territory. No, your territory is on our Taliban. So there is this active discord between the two states that take place in a very public way. And I think there is concern about the composition of that government. And I think Pakistanis are probably not incorrect when they sense that they're a victim of terrorism, at least in part because of what the U.S. is doing and what's happening in the region, that they're not just victims of terrorism because of backlash straight up. So the bottom line is we can't really unpack this. I was very surprised at how unaware urban Pakistanis were of something as basic as the Durand Line. So we can't really unpack it. But I think the general atmospherics might be something that's being picked up in the survey.
Well, if there's no more questions, then I'd like to say one thing. I think an important message of this poll is that conducting relations on the U.S.'s part with Pakistan in the framework of a patron-client relationship is simply not working, that it is a model that is not a fit, and that the U.S. Really has nothing to lose by abandoning this illusion and attempting to have a relationship with the Pakistani people and state and civil society, all three, and see what it's like to go through this experiment. And so if there's nothing else, then thank you so much.
Thank you.
All
Oh, sure.
Yeah.